broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network. This is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
Dean Becker, Steve Nolan is our engineer. We invite you to join us as we examine the unvarnished truth about the drug war.
Good evening. Welcome to Cultural Baggage. We have several guests with us tonight. First up, we have from the state of California, Judge James P. Gray, who's running for a U.S. Senate seat, and we'll bring him on here in just a second. We also have with us tonight Judge Robert Voigt. We have with us also Reginald McCamey, who's running for district attorney here in Harris County. And I believe we do have the judge on the line. Hello, Judge Gray.
Dean, I am here indeed. It's always nice to talk to you.
And certainly you're always welcome on Cultural Baggage. Thank you for joining us. Judge Gray, I understand there's been a bit of contention out there in that race and that the League of Women Voters did not let you attend the debate. You want to talk to us about that, sir?
Well, Dean, I think it's critically important that we in our country have a third voice. The third parties really do contribute mightily, I think, to our political thought and our government. And so the League of Women Voters did schedule a debate between the Democrat and the Republican, Barbara Boxer and Bill Jones, and I tried very hard to be a part of that. They said, oh, no, well, you have to poll 10%. So we commissioned a poll and polled, depending on you read the poll, either 8 to 18%. And then they changed the rules and said, oh, no, it has to be neutral. You can't pay for it yourself. Well, unfortunately, the accepted neutral polls ask people, well, do you want to vote for Barbara Boxer or Bill Jones or other, but they wouldn't include my name. So we tried, we were unsuccessful, and basically I think democracy lost. Obviously nobody discussed the drug war, nobody talked about the Patriot Act, at least truthfully, and there were a lot of issues that simply were not discussed that would have been fully discussed had I been a part.
Let's tell them about some of the planks, if you will, of your platform. The look at the drug war, the look at the Patriot Act. What would they have heard given that chance?
Well, first of all, it's clear to most people that what we're doing with regard to the war on drugs is not working. You can't look to the government to change it because the government's making huge amounts of tax money and they are addicted to that money. So a major plank in my campaign, Dean, is to get the federal government out of marijuana prohibition. Let's just talk about marijuana. And that way we would allow each state to decide how best to serve its people. And by the way, I know, as you know, when we finally repealed alcohol prohibition, we didn't say, okay, now Texas or Oklahoma will serve alcohol. We didn't do anything of the kind. We just said the federal government's out of it, and each state can decide how best to serve its people and what to do. I would lobby the state of California, or anyone else for that matter, to treat marijuana like alcohol. We could, in effect, three things would happen immediately if that were to occur. Number one is that we would save taxpayers of California at least $1 billion every year that we now try to spend to eradicate marijuana and prosecute and incarcerate nonviolent marijuana users. Even through all of that, of course, marijuana is the largest cash crop in the state of California today. Number two is grapes, if you care. So obviously we've been unsuccessful there. Second thing that we'd do is we could generate income. You know, you can tax it. And we could generate income of about $1.5 billion. Now, that's a $2.5 billion shift in our budget deficit, and I think that that would make an impression on people. And the third thing is more important than the first two, and that is we'd make marijuana less available for our children than it is today. Why? Because the illegal dealers do not ask for identification. So that's the first thing we'd talk about. The second is, as you mentioned, the Patriot Act. It's a direct frontal assault on our civil liberties. It does not make us more secure, more safe, but it is leading us toward being a police state. Now, the war on drugs has done the same, but we are simply taking away the human rights and the civil liberties of our people, and I cannot stand to have that occur without doing everything I can to focus some light on it. There are other issues, too, but those are two of them.
The impingement of our rights that comes about through this drug war have been used in the war of terror to go after us even further in that regard. Am I right?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. In fact, you'll hear our present president tout that, saying, oh, we want to use the same tools against terrorists, so-called, that we use against drug dealers. Well, it isn't working with regard to drug dealers, and it won't work with regard to terrorists. In fact, you know, I tell people all the time, let's not fall for this label or this state of mind of a war on terrorism. There is no, you can't declare war on an idea or actions even, or entities or things like drugs. Can't declare war on poverty. It just doesn't work. This is a very serious, important police action, and we should have told the world, you know, we're going to find out who did this 9/11 stuff. We're going to bring them to justice. We're going to punish them. But you can't declare a war upon an idea. And no leader in of any note in world history that I know of would have color-coded our degree of fear for the moment. You know, we're now in an amber alert or a yellow or an orange, listening to all these colors I've never heard of. But we'll never get to a stage green, I assure you, that no one will ever say, oh, we've accomplished our purpose, the war is over. It's great for politicians. It is not good for civil liberties, and it's not good for the people.
Well, Judge Gray, I know there are a couple of stations in California that receive this program. What might you tell them in regards to this coming vote for the Senate seat?
Well, I'll tell all of your listeners, Dean, anyone, of course, that lives and votes in California, I do request that you vote for Judge Jim Gray, a Libertarian for United States Senate. But everyone listening to me knows some people that live and vote in California. And if you will just ask them to visit my website, judgejim.com, J-I-M, judgejim.com. We have lots of information there. You send us an email message, and we'll send you information back. And then you can forward that information on to your email universe. It is amazing what we can do together. And all of the Republican and Democrats' money, and they have plenty, with regard to advertising, will not be able to touch anyone who gets a personal endorsement from a friend. So that's what I request they do. Certainly we can use some financial support if they want to help there, too, and we'll put more ads of our own on the radio and television. But the personal contact, you proselytize, you talk to people that live in California, that vote in California, and tell them that they have a viable, positive option. Because I may not win the race, and I understand that that's a reality of life, but if I make a strong showing, literally every vote that I get will stand up and be counted in favor of getting the federal government out of marijuana prohibition. And I can tell you, the Republicans and Democrats will look at our votes as being the difference between winning and losing future elections. I assure you they're going to want those votes. The only way they get them is to change their policies. And, of course, if they change their policies, then we will have won the election. So make your vote count. Judge Jim Gray for U.S. Senate, your vote will count.
Judge Jim Gray, I thank you once again for visiting us here, and we'll be in touch soon, sir.
Sounds good to me, Dean, and you're doing good work, so keep it up.
Thank you, sir.
Be well. Okay.
Right. Bye-bye. Okay, folks, you are listening to Cultural Baggage, and we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in 1 minute with our three guests in studio.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. Depression, delusions, hallucinations, paranoid fears, clinical depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, tardive dyskinesia, and psychosis. Time's up. The answer? Ritalin, another FDA-approved product.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of DrugSense. You're listening to Cultural Baggage. To end the drug war, visit MAPINC.org. That's MAPINC.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed, and let's bring an end to this nonsense.
I'm hungry.
According to the forthcoming Victory Act, if you buy a bag from someone who bought a bag from someone who bought a bag from someone who knew someone who was a terrorist, you'll be subject to 20 years to life. Happy Halloween.
Okay, we do have with us in studio Judge Robert Voigt. We have Leslie Rivnick, who's also running for a judgeship here in Houston. And we have with us Mr. Reginald McAmey, who's running for the district attorney. I'm going to start with you, Reginald. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Reginald McAmey. I'm the Democratic nominee for Harris County District Attorney. Thank you for having me.
Yes, sir. I understand there was a recent debate or discussion, if you will, with you and the current District Attorney, Mr. Chuck Rosenthal. Tell us about that, if you will.
There was. We had a debate at St. Thomas University Sunday. It was from 3 till 4. We discussed a lot of different issues. I think everybody that was there saw that he had one side of the issue spectrum, and I had another. He's tall, I'm short. He's, you know, he's got white hair. I got no hair. We got a lot of differences. you know, honestly, there's a lot of differences between what we want to do for the people of Harris County and how we want to do it.
Well, I personally have interviewed Mr. Rosenthal, mm-hmm. and he seems to want more of the same, which has been a hopeless failure in my book.
Correct. And we discussed that. I told him I felt his policies were an embarrassment for Harris County nationally and internationally. When you look at the Andrea Yates case, where he went after the death penalty for a mentally ill woman, if you look at the DNA lab, his refusal to step aside after 22 Republican criminal district court judges requested that he step aside. If you look at the many capital murder cases that they go after and waste a lot of taxpayers' money, and you look at the many people that we send to TDC from Harris County, I believe Harris County sends about 60% of the people that are in TDC to TDC.
It's outrageous. One of the reasons why is the ineptitude of the crime lab, and we have a gentleman with us, Les Rivnik, who understands that quite well. Les, how are you this evening?
Doing fine. Howdy.
Howdy. Welcome. Les, well, we had an earlier discussion about the DNA and the crime lab and its implications to the drug testing, in fact. Tell us a bit about what you've observed.
There are problems. The public knows that. They've read the reports in the news, seen on television about the scandal in the DNA lab. What I'd like to point out to the public is that the DNA lab is the front end of the scandal. That's where the problems originated. However, they didn't end there. The rest of the scandal, the back end of the scandal, is in the courtrooms, where in hundreds, if not thousands of cases, bad evidence came into the trial. It was presented to the jury. The question is, how did bad evidence come in before the jury? The judge is there to be an ultimate arbiter and an applier of the rules of evidence and rules of procedure, which are designed to make sure that evidence that does come before the jury is valid and reliable. What happened in the courtrooms in hundreds and thousands of trials where bad evidence came in? What happened was a failure. The judges did not apply the rules. The prosecution did not follow the rules. The defense lawyers did not make challenges that were permissible under the rules. There's a colossal failure in the courtroom of all parties involved, where ultimately the integrity of the trial process was tainted.
That brings to mind that, you know, the old accounting joke of how much do you want it to be, you know, when asked 2 + 2. And I think that's what the crime lab presented on behalf of the DA, is whatever evidence or whatever result they thought was appropriate. That's just my take on it. It seems to be prevalent enough.
I think that happened in at least one case. There was a case where Libby Johnson, who was an assistant medical examiner, was asked by an assistant district attorney to conform a report to the theory that the assistant DA wanted to pursue in the course of a trial. She refused to do it. The case was taken away from her and assigned to another assistant medical examiner. She was fired. She brought a whistleblower lawsuit, and she won and won a substantial sum of money from Harris County. So I think there's one documented case of that happening. I think there's a more fundamental, more structural problem at the root of it. It's that there's an unjustified reliance on science. There's an unjustified faith that science and scientists and technicians will always get it right. And as it's developed in development of Texas and American jurisprudence, it's gone by rather uncritically. That DNA analysis was going to somehow provide magical, mystical, but reliable identification of suspects. And nobody bothered to take a look at the complicated, sophisticated techniques that go into it and look for the possibilities of error, the sources of error, the sources of failure. And the DAs, judges, defense lawyers, all routinely relied on the validity of the science without knowing the science intimately enough to challenge the pathologies, the weaknesses that go along with it.
Wouldn't you agree, though, with me, Les, that it was also a failure to really delve into how the prosecutors were using the evidence and soliciting testimony from the DNA lab employees?
Yes, you're right. Now, there was misdoing on the part of the prosecutors, but there's also misdoings in the form of omission by defense lawyers who are there positioned to challenge the evidence that the DA puts in. And a lot of that problem was that many of the cases came about with appointed counsel, where they were dependent upon the courts to provide them with the proper resources to represent the indigent, and the courts weren't doing it. The judges were not providing indigent counsels with the resources to properly challenge the DA's evidence.
And I want to introduce our other guest in studio with us. We have Robert Voigt.
In relation to the drug laboratories, the DNA lab, etc., we've got to bear one thing in mind, though. There's plenty of blame to go around. Until such time as we have independent laboratories which are not a part of the police system or some other law enforcement system, we will never have an unbiased process. The only way to have fairness and a lack of bias in this process is to separate the drug labs, make them independent, not beholden to the DA's office or to the defense bar or anybody else, because we all tend to be partisans. And when the drug lab is a part of a HPD, for example, there's always the tendency to help the side that you're allied with, which is the police, the district attorney's office. And the case of Libby Johnson is a proof of that. The woman said these things weren't right, and what did she get for it? Instead of being applauded and saying you're right and help, she got fired for it. You can be a district attorney and want to look at some evidence, drugs. You can go there, they'll make an arrangement, show it to you. If you're a defense lawyer, most of you're going to need a court order to see that stuff. And that's just not right. Another thing, as Les just said, these are complicated processes that are done in the DNA laboratory, and most of the people there are have no higher than a bachelor's degree, a four-year degree. In any organization where you have any research done, you're going to have doctors. In most organizations, at least, you need a master's to do any type of work of that sort, but we don't have that in the DNA laboratory. And we have people that are basically not scientists, but machine operators. They run through. You ask a lot of these people. I've seen it happen in court. You ask them for the formula for cocaine. The people in drug lab, they won't know it. All they do is put things through machines
and look at a certain result and yes or no.
And the analogy I make is that these people, I don't see much difference from the person that's driving a car. You know, they turn the switch, they turn the key, the engine starts, they put it in drive, and they drive off. But they don't know what's happening under the hood.
Right. Fair enough. Now, when I interviewed Chuck Rosenthal, I asked him, did he know the origins of the drug law? Does he know the basis, the science, the reasoning behind it? And, of course, he did not. He just says, when the only tool you have to work with is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And, Reginald, I wanted to ask you, it's not all a nail. These are people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they're people that need to be treated with dignity and respect because they're Harris County residents. Many of them are taxpayers. If they're not taxpayers, their parents are taxpayers, and we need to treat everybody with dignity and respect, and we need to look at the cases on an individual basis, and we need to have justice and fairness down in the criminal court system, and that's why I'm running for district attorney.
Les Rivnik, let me ask you this. Dallas has had a tremendous scandal. It's not necessarily the crime lab, but it might as well be with the tainted evidence up there, the sheetrock presented as methamphetamine and cocaine. How can judges make that determination? You talked earlier about the defense attorneys don't look at the science and so forth. What can the judges do in that regard to help protect the people they represent?
Well, the simple answer is they do not allow the evidence to come in. In the course of a trial, one side proffers the other evidence, the other side has the opportunity to object to it. There can be some argument back and forth whether it should or should not come in, but the judge has a final decision as to whether or not that evidence comes in, whether it's oral testimony or something physical or something scientific or just more lay opinion. And the judge has the opportunity and has the duty to say, no, you've not met the proper predicate. The rules of evidence in place, Rule 902 in particular regarding expert testimony, that says that the evidence has got to be shown to be reliable, it's got to be shown to be valid and well-grounded in accepted science. That's the thumbnail sketch. But I won't go into all the details and bore your listeners with a lot of legalisms and legalities. However, the judge is the arbiter of the rules. The judge is the gatekeeper to prevent invalid, unreliable evidence from coming before the jury. The judge is absolutely crucial. Now, the DA has a role, the defense has a role, they're all crucial roles, but the final role is that of the judge.
Go ahead, Robert Voigt. Go ahead, sir.
We've got to remember that we've got 23 of those judges are former prosecutors, and we have a tendency, as I think I said before, to be partisans. Let me tell you what a career track is for a judge today. Very often, these folks go to college, go to law school. Sometimes they go to law school without having any job in between. They go to the district attorney's office, sometimes as young as 25, fresh out of law school. They stay there for 15 years. When they're 40, they run unopposed for the bench as Republicans, and they take the bench. Now, what have they done? They've had, they're 40 years old, fairly young, you know, for somebody that's got to make a lot of judgment calls. They have spent 15 years at the district attorney's office, and most of the people they associate with are their fellow assistant district attorneys, people they've had lunch with, had dinner with, going to parties with, and it, they don't get a lot of perspective. One job in their entire career, and when they get up on the bench, they have a tendency, and some of them, I'm glad to say, some of them evolve and they grow and they do things right. But there is a tendency, and I can think of some now, that they are biased toward the prosecution, and very much so. And I think that's unfortunate, and I wish we could change. And I wish we could have people from both sides on the bench, not from not only from the prosecution side, but we need people from the defense bar, too, to give some balance. Ideally, we should have people that have done both. But it's unfortunate that we have this bias, and that a lot of people aren't really big enough for the post, because to be a judge, you've got to have several things. And of course, a knowledge of the law is one of them, and it's important. But I think the most important thing is to be a reasonable person, and to have a deep sense of honesty and fair play, to have a courteous demeanor, and to make people feel welcome in court and allow people to have their time in court. And in this sense, I might add that there is a tendency to want to keep your docket down because it's become almost a political issue. And what is happening now is that in many courts, lawyers are appointed by the judges, and there's a tendency to have them, to want to have them plead the cases out. People aren't getting their day in court. It's much easier to plead a case out. It takes 5 minutes, whereas having a trial might take a day or two. And the shining promise of our Constitution that guarantees us a trial by jury is being frustrated.
Indeed it is. I think that's quite obvious that the majority of drug cases in particular, these are the ones that I've observed and watched, nearly all plead out for some, you know, instead of a chance at 20, they'll take 3 years or even a probation, but then you have to do the urine test and you've got to pass, you know.
I was talking yesterday to a person who has a friend who was on 10 years probation, and after doing 7 years probation right, they got a technical violation, and they were revoked and sent to prison. The probation, long probation terms don't really make much sense. If you have a short probation, a person can stay out of trouble for, let's say, 2 years, 3 years, that's long enough. That way they can get on with their life when they're through that. And you have the added advantage of you lower the amount of people on probation, which means that the probation department has a lower caseload, and now they can oversee their probationers more effectively.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that you really have to look at, in here in Texas, I believe the number is about 60% or more of the people that are in Texas Department of Corrections are there for less than a gram of cocaine.
Yes.
That's an astronomical number when you think that you are housing people for $35,000 to $40,000 a year for having about a $40 amount of drugs on them.
Less than a sugar packet.
Yeah, less than a sugar packet. So we really need to look at what is the cost to society to house and do these things that we're doing for less than a sugar pack of cocaine, and whether it makes sense. The other thing we need to look at is we're destroying the citizens that can be productive.
Yes.
Once they get a record, once they get a felony, you know, they can't come back to society, really go and get a job that's going to be meaningful. And generally, they can't. You know, you find a few exceptions where people do, but it's a hard recovery once you've been incarcerated and trying to get back on your feet. You know, we need to look at alternatives. When there's medical issues, we need to treat them with medical solutions. And if somebody is a bad person and they're doing bad things in the community, they're hurting people, then they need to be put away, and they need to be put away a long time. But these minor offenses where, you know, they're not hurting people, we need to treat that differently. We need to use the drug courts extensively. We need to have more drug courts, and we need to increase the use of pretrial diversion, you know, and other things in the court.
Unless, what do we have now? One drug court? Or what?
We have one drug court, and, it's only a pilot project. It was very, very late in its creation. 77th legislature several years ago passed legislation creating drug courts in five major Texas cities.
Well, this district attorney fought it for two years.
Exactly. He fought it for 2 years, nor were the judges terribly interested in getting it off the ground.
Yeah.
There was the interruption of Tropical Storm Allison, which was used as an excuse for not going forward with it. Mm-hmm. However, every other major city that it used, Austin, Dallas, for example, they had a drug court in place within 6 months. This drug court didn't come into existence until 1 year ago this month.
Yeah.
And even then, they ran out of money by the spring, and they had only 50 cases. And they've got some more money now. Supposedly they're cherry-picking another 50 cases for that. This is a county where we've got over 90,000 felony cases in a year, and they're struggling to find financing for just 100 cases. The drug court sits for a couple of hours every Friday, and that is it. Furthermore, it's not designed for first-time offenders. It's being used for people who are on probation at risk of violating their probation or have already violated their probation. So it's for people who are to be given a second chance when they've already been given a second chance on probation. It's hardly a robust and hale and hearty program designed to identify early on, especially with first-time offenders, a drug problem that can be treated medically or therapeutically. I'd like to use this as a segue to comment on something that Robert mentioned, that talking about the length of probation periods. I don't think there's any magic number for a period of probation, whether it's 1 year, 10 years, 5 years, whatever. I think what counts is the needs, the rehabilitative needs of the individual probationer. You've got to tailor the probation terms to the individual with due regard to both his punishment and rehabilitation needs.
Thank you. Les Rivnik, we're running out of time here, and I want to give you guys a chance to talk to your constituents out there and what you want to do. Let's give 30 seconds apiece. We're going to start with Robert Voigt over here.
I'm Robert Voigt, V-O-I-G-T. I'm on the Democratic Party ballot, but we would appreciate your vote. Vote us into office. We will give you reason, common sense, and fair play, and that's what we need to make a good system, because an honest and fair judicial system is a bulwark of the republic.
Thank you, Robert. Now we go to Les Rivnik.
Again, my name is Les Rivnik. I think if you listen to all three of us here, you can tell that we bring a different vision, a different perspective to the races that we're running for. Vote your conscience, vote your thoughts, and vote for us.
Thank you, Les. And now we go to Reginald McCamey.
Yes, thank you very much, and thank your audience for listening. What I would tell the audience is that we have a historic opportunity. We need everyone to get out and vote. I want to encourage you to get your friends and neighbors out to vote. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen all. I appreciate you being with us. A couple of program notes before we go. I want to say hi to the folks at KRFP up in Moscow, Idaho. Welcome to the Drug Truth Network. We're glad you're with us. If you're listening to KOS, K-O-S, in Olympia, Washington, call the station manager. Tell him to keep this on the air. Our DJ is leaving, but we need you to hang with us.
To hear this week's Poppygate report, please visit drugtruth.net. Listen to the Halloween 420 Drug War News Report. Please make that vote count.
Now, as always, because of drug prohibition, I remind you, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
Freedom is on the march.
For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Tap dancing on the edge of an abyss.